So let's talk about corn just a little bit. Dan Zwicker is on the end. He's with CGB Enterprises. And yes, he does live down in New Orleans. And yes, he flew here so that he could be with us today from Mandeville. Thank you so much, Dan, for coming up. Kurt Kimmel is next to him. Kurt didn't go very far at all because he's right here in Normal, Illinois. He is the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities. And I actually brought Jackie Bakes with me because we only live about a mile apart. And then next to Jackie is Mike Zuzulo, who's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. And I'm going to guess you drove here yesterday.
I did.
Is that right? From Atchison, Kansas. So he had a long drive. I love talking with him because we have conversations about the market that I hope make real sense to you over time and over the long haul. If you listen to all of them over time, you really get a good perspective of what's happening in the marketplace. Sometimes they agree, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they don't. I actually like it better when they don't because it's more fun. It's more fun on the air to do it that way. So let's start, Michael Zuzulo, with you. I just kind of want a broad perspective of the corn market to get us started, please.
Thank you for the invitation. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. It's great to be back and see a lot of familiar faces. Broad perspective of the corn market, I would say that the upside potential would be best earlier in the marketing year, that if the currency markets and the demand market reestablishes itself as a prominent mover in the price trend, it could be like the mid to late 1990s, where December corn in 97, 98, and 99 all had highs in March and corrected about 20% going into the July 4th holiday. Interesting side note, I was talking to Bruce Sherrick, is it Sherrick, with a CK, had never met him before, was amazed by his presentation, especially with the S&P and the farmland prices and the risk that the market and those graphs perceived. And I sat with him a few minutes after he talked, and I told him my fear of when the Federal Reserve raises interest rates in mid-2015 is the expectation. That seems kind of scary because it was right before the 1994 Mexican financial crisis that the Fed started to raise rates. It was right before the Argentine debt crisis of 1999 that the Fed started to raise rates. And he said, it's apples and oranges. And I said, I'm going to give you a call next week. So, but that's my initial impression, is that the if the demand comes into play more and the currencies lift off for the dollar and deflation takes place, then we'll have an earlier high in corn and then have difficulty, other than the supply side and the weather and the good old normal stuff, to battle.
Jackie Vakes, it's been a unique fall, especially because of the issues related to rail. And the slowdown of harvest, although it seemed to go pretty fast, eventually, there are huge piles of corn that are out and about, but the basis hasn't been completely wrecked. Why is that the case?
Well, I think when you look at the basis situation, it's again goes back to the rail issues and logistics, not being able to get things where they need to go. And anytime you have that type of a circumstance, I think that you're going to see a better basis because, well, look at Decatur. I mean, you know, Decatur was in need of corn so badly. They grind about 800,000 bushels a day. And over the 6 weeks prior to harvest, they were running out of corn every day. Right now, from what I understand, they still are not able to get in the right amount of corn to be able to meet their needs. And so until they can, basis is going to be better, and they're going to try and shake it out of you guys. And I'm sure they're shaking in their boots right now as we get close to Thanksgiving and then into the Christmas holiday, because not a lot of grain moves during those periods of time unless you really see a big increase in price as well as an improvement in basis. And so I think that we've been given a gift in some ways because the weather slowed harvest down enough that some of your elevators could catch up with them with what they needed. And at the same time, we got a price increase when we normally would never get a price increase, especially in the face of this large a crop. And I'm going to just allude quickly to tag on to what Mike said about the dollar. If you look at the Japanese yen today versus the dollar, it's at 118.40. Now, CGB and Zenor are together, where Dan works, and about 4 weeks ago, there were four guys from Zendo that were in a local elevator, and one of my clients was in there, and he said they were just hitting him up every way they could to find out how much is land worth. What are you paying for rent? What are you doing this? What are you doing that? And he said when he finally got done, he looked at him and said, I just have a question for you guys. What do you think about our corn and bean prices? And they, all four of them, he said it was just like listen to a quartet. Way too high, okay? So what does way too high mean? 370 corn, which is where we were at today with the exchange rate, is at 438. That's old crop corn, before they even ship it to Japan. 413 new crop is at 489 before they ship it. And, you know, Japan was our number one corn buyer last year. So they've been quite absent in the marketplace. So for the moment, all of the logistics problems we have are very much supporting the market. But eventually, we'll see the real market.
Okay, Kurt, what's the real market?
Real market. Well, that's been a tough one in here, just the fact that guys don't know whether it be a fundamentals or a technician, you know, back and forth. And if I was you guys, I'd be a technician for a while here. This seems to be working fairly well and keep a good thing going. But the thing I want to point out is the Elliott Wave guys. They've got the market going sideways here through the early part of winter. Got a little bump maybe right after the first year. If you're a conspiracy theory guy, February's going to be down. But the Elliott Wave guys got a low first part of March. Once we get through first part of March, upside objective in corn's 523. So they see something come along in here to give reason to be optimistic down the road. Just to add one thing on the dollar. Corn export is the next area of growth that we really need to see take hold. We start taking a dollar up above this 98, 100, 101, that could be effect. But Japan is very important, as Jackie said, because they're facing some financial situations there. But you got to remember, though, back in the 80s, if there's a fear of any type of short production materialized, they've been notorious. Money's no matter. They've been buyers at the high. So in order to get Japan to step up purchases, you're going to have to put some fear to God in them.
Well, I thought I maybe had only one bull on the panel, but maybe I have more than one, but hang on.
Oh, geez.
Hi, Dan.
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah. You're going to get me in trouble again. Jackie, all grain merchandisers think things are always too high. You'll never find a grain merchandiser that thinks things are a bargain. Those same merchandisers all thought corn was going to have a 2 in front of it and an 8 in front of it, and they just missed that by a few dollars, maybe a dollar on corn. Basically, I'm, as you've heard on WLL, I follow the seasonals, and I think you have to, and basically all corn and soybeans are doing right now is following an average seasonal pattern. There is nothing unusual about it. The only thing unusual about this year was the big crop made everybody, it was too easy to sell, so the bear got super short, and then some. And all of these big crop reports started coming out, and the market stopped going down. And USDA misled the trade all year long with their bean carryout number at 130 million bushels. And I can criticize USDA now since all my fraternity brothers have retired from NASS. Otherwise, it would be a pretty dangerous situation going back to Founders Day and summer meetings. But USDA has lost a lot of its intelligence from 2007 on. The baby boomers, all my age, they all retired in 07 and 08. And a whole bunch of young whippersnappers have come in there that probably can't tell you the difference between a corn plant and a soybean plant. And they don't have the qualified people that they had years ago, and that's one of the reasons why USDA reports have been very volatile over the past 5 to 7 years. USDA was probably the only department that resisted political pressures from the White House, and I'm not too sure They've been able to withstand those political pressures. Everything coming out of Washington, whether it's the Labor Department or the whatever department you want to do, is all politically related one way or the other. I think currently USDA's got a bad acreage miss in the works. It's about like anything. Once you miss something, you wait till the very last minute until you finally have to fess up. And it'll be interesting what USDA will come at us in the January crop report. The trade has been talking about this acreage discrepancy for some time. I understand the discrepancy, but it does look like there's a big miss. And we'll find out on the January report. Now, if they don't fess up to the acreage miss, then all of a sudden there's going to be a big, huge, unexplained disappearance in the balance sheet. That's one way USDA can kind of cover up their mistakes. But I think seasonally, this weakness that we're seeing is very seasonally correct. It's not uncommon for beans to have a little setback in the last half of November, and then usually by the first part of December, they resume the seasonal climb as you go into January. Corn, it's not uncommon for corn to weaken as we go into first week of December, as you go into the December delivery period. And then if you can't make new lows at that point in time, the market then has a tendency to regroup, and you have a very strong seasonal to the upside. Now, I think that is going to be, as we get into next week, is going to be real critical. This big crop, and basically this is what happened to the soybeans, is if you look at how aggressive the processor or the crusher was in selling soybean meal into the export market, the exporter selling soybeans into the export market, they got very, very aggressive later this summer and early fall with ideas that this big, humongous crop was coming at them, and then they would be able to meet all that demand, and all of a sudden farmers kind of took their time harvesting. And then we got into a couple of weeks of weather delay, and everything's gone wrong from that point forward. There's a lot of cash traders that are super short out there. The exported trader keeps rolling his short forward because it's more profitable to load soybeans right now. So I think once the soybeans are pretty well loaded, we're going to switch from the vessel market to containers. China has sent thousands of containers over here for Christmas gifts, and they ain't going back to China empty.
Are you done?
And that's one reason why the soybeans...
Oh, that's only one reason.
Yeah, that's one reason.
But didn't we, weren't we on corn when he started?
But then the corn market's going to kick in. The export demand is better than I think what the trade wants you to believe at the moment. It's not fantastic, but it is going to kick in at some point in time.
I believe that tax auditors are going to be in Waco this winter. Now, there's a lot of moving parts here, and that's going to set up for a dynamic January crop report as far as they try to finalize acres. There's ideas we could lower yield. All of a sudden, you got the carryout down to about 1.6. You take a 1.6 carryout into next year, all of a sudden, a few less acres next year, trend line yield, keep demand fairly stout for, say, you're down to about 1.2. Then you throw some weather on that, and there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of fireworks. But two, as Dan mentioned, container market. China loves to go under the radar. They've been doing the container market for years. They've come in and virtually wiped out sorghum under the radar and through here. You know, when you're watching the front door, they're coming in the back door. And I think one thing to watch is retail sales. These containers are not going to go back empty. I know it's a lot of small things, but I think that's what's going to fly under the radar here for a while.
I just finished telling Dan that I was not going to ever respectfully disagree with him again, but I am going to respectfully disagree with them, primarily about the USDA. You know, one of the things that he and I have never agreed on is the USDA, and primarily because, in my particular opinion, if you're going to really bash the USDA, you're bashing the people who give them the information, which is you guys. I mean, they're asking you for information. If you're not giving them correct information, then I think it's pretty hard to come up with accurate numbers. And so when you look at the big picture, it wasn't the USDA that decided that they weren't going to have a farm bill this year and that people could delay their FSA certification. And that has really thrown a huge rock into the system, because normally we would have a very good acreage number at this point in time, but we don't. And I talked to one of the head guys at the USDA in October before the report came out, and you know what his comment was? Do we have to put a report out? We really don't have good numbers. We're trying to work with the FSA to estimate where we might be. And so this is really, I don't disagree with Dan in the idea that we may not have accurate numbers in January. I don't think we will, because guys have until the end of December to certify. And I have some very large farmers that have not certified at all yet. So I don't know how we can expect them to have accurate numbers. And I think the thing, and if you've listened to me for any length of time, you know, if you look at the bottom of a USDA number, it has what they call a deviation on it. So when you see these prices, recognize that when you first start the crop, you have a 10% deviation on that. Why? Do they know what you're going to plant? Do we know what yield is going to be? Do we know what weather's going to be? No. But they still have to guide us, and they're still our best source to give us some type of a framework as to where we may be going. And, you know, it's great to hope that prices are going to go higher, but hope is not a strategy, and hope is not risk management. And so, you know, I'd like to sit here and hope that it goes up to that level, but I'm more concerned about what if it doesn't? And what if you end up with $3 corn? Where are you going to be then?
Concerned enough you've come up with a strategy?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we've been strategizing for such a long time already. I mean, you know, one of the things I think that, rather than even talking about a current strategy, is I wish that each of you would take the time to recognize the opportunities that you have and that you've had, so that you can put it in your back pocket and say, for the future, I really want to keep this in mind. There were guys that bought put options on corn back when it was 570. Do you remember when it was 570? A year ago in June? They bought put options for 2014 to try and cover crop insurance prices, is basically what it was. That's what they were thinking about. And, you know, you could do the same thing. You just have to learn how to use the tools that are there. But I think, personally, looking at the marketplace, we are going to have to become much more like livestock people. Livestock people are always looking further ahead. We've never really had to do that or adapted to that well. And in order to survive, I think you have to try and take every opportunity that there is. So if you're just doing it in cash, you don't necessarily have that opportunity. I'm always going to look to cash first. Tell me what cash is doing. If you're a client of mine, you're going to know that. But at the very same time, if you went and you wanted to sell, you were determined you were going to sell, and you went to the elevator, and you didn't like the basis, and you didn't sell, then you should have been doing something either in the futures or in the options, because you knew there was a reason you wanted to sell. And if you didn't, because you don't understand what's going on in that area, you owe it to yourself to learn how to do that.
I think it was Gulkey earlier, Jerry told me, Jerry, just tell me whether this is right. You told us earlier today that next year farmers were probably in the Dakotas going to put more bean acres in, but because they couldn't move their corn, they were just going to store it, and they're just going to leave it for a couple of years, right? So it comes off the market. It essentially comes out of the market because they can't rail it, they can't move it. Does this change anything in the way you think about how much corn is available, what basis will look like, and what the market reaction might be under... My Dan, don't smirk. That's a bullish thing. But does it change anything in your thought process? And does it add to your knowledge about what's happening in the market and why it's... I mean, when you hit it, it's low, but it doesn't go.
Yeah, I think you put together that and the Upper Mississippi River closing in Minneapolis, and I think it really adds a flavor that the basis can move in a more favorable manner for those storing on farm for a time period here this winter, more than the futures would. Without the futures, the corn futures, that is, getting and regaining some export demand. The ethanol demand is fantastic. The livestock demand is fantastic. The export demand seems to be the weak link that, the, as Dan said, the bears in the trade are really focusing on right now, even though our year-to-date inspections are up about 20%. But if you combine those two things with what Jerry said and with the Upper Mississippi River, then you have a basis play. I will say a couple quick things about what Jackie and Dan and Kurt have been talking about. I don't think you can underestimate the power. If you're talking about a market that is less supply-centric and more demand-centric, and I think that's where corn is, because I too think the demand can improve in the export market as long as we don't price ourselves out. You also have to, I think, realize that the currency markets become more important once again because you're talking about demand. And the correlation between corn and the Japanese yen is extremely strong. I did a correlation chart in that newsletter that we brought with us. Get one if you haven't already. You're talking about a 60, 70, 80% correlation between the price of corn, lead month futures, and the Japanese yen on a 12-month basis. So combine that with the idea that Japan has been trying to come back from deflation for 20 years. And they came back and pressed the quantitative easing button again and spurred the Chinese to press the quantitative easing button this past weekend because, guess what, they don't have inflation. So to me, in the analysis I do, 2014 was a watershed year for the Japanese. They were either going to get their inflation back through Abenomics and it was going to really keep the dollar pinned down, or they were going to fail again and it was going to bring the currencies back to the forefront. Second quick point, Steve and I were talking about this earlier today. It's so funny that this got brought up because we were talking about the inefficiencies of these grain markets. I'm glad the USDA, from a selfish perspective, I'm glad the USDA is changing their numbers so much because it gives me job security. But for you, it's not so good. But think about it. Think about a $5 over basis 2.5 months ago in soybeans. The whole market knew the soybean carryover was not as high. The crushers knew the soybean carryover was not as high. The $5 basis was out there for 2 or 3 weeks. They were changing it on an hourly basis. What helped create that was the USDA would not bring their numbers down in a timely manner, even though the census report said to do it. So we need to get used to that until times change. And that's why that distinction that Bill Mayer talked about earlier on the panel, cash versus futures, that's what's so important to me, is you're going to have these basis plays. Let's put it out there right now for 450 million bushel carryover in beans. What if it goes up to 550 million bushels this coming year? Maybe that $4 over bean basis in that we had earlier this year in 9 months from now could be a $3 under basis. This is the type of inefficiency, even with the automated traders, because guess what? They use the USDA data too, and they just plug it into their algorithms. Yep. So it's a less efficient market, and it's going to cause more basis swings because the futures and the cash are going to be disagreeing with one another because the government data is not bringing those two together.
Yeah. See, what's the name of that gene? MIR, is that right? The MIR gene?
162, yeah.
And that's going to continue to be the problem.
The question was that really screwed up the container market, and what does it do over time?
And I actually, you know, you guys are going to do what you want to do, but I know I'm not going to be invited to do any Syngenta meetings, but I'm not going to be invited to do anything one of these days. I think it's you got to be awful careful. I mean, you remember, you guys are all in it together. And this non-approved stuff, even though it may not be that big a deal, but you never want to give your buyer a reason not to buy from you.
Right.
It's not, you know, we're not the only supplier in the world. We are a very reliable supplier. We got high quality supplies.
Yep.
But you don't want to give your buyer any reason not to buy. And I think when you go out and start planting non-approved products, you're running the risk of screwing up a lot of export activity, and that's the hangover that you're seeing right now in the DDG market. And that's going to be a long time to recoup.
Yeah.
Other questions out here? I can add. Yes? So he wants to plant 88 million acres of corn, and yield is trend, so 163. And we have a 12A crop, so he's done the numbers for you. Dan.
Well, I think if you want to be super bearish anything, probably soybeans is probably the place that you want to lay down the marker, because that does look like that could get out of hand. If South America goes ahead and has a big crop. But we got a ways to go on that. But if you look at corn, take that yellow sheet that's got base commodities. I'm going to give them free advertisement here for a second. Go over here to your far left. Go to the 94-95 crop year. And that was a record year at 138.6. That was, you know, a 38-bushel jump from the previous year of 93-94. Of course, that was a flood year. And then the following year, we fell back to 113. Okay, go to the 2004-2005. That was, for some reason, we had 04s, or the year ending in 04 has record yields. 04 was a record yield at 160. Prior to that, we had 142. And then the following year, we fell back to 148. You go to this year at 173, if that holds. I question whether or not that holds. But, you know, last year we had 158.8. Okay, the odds say next year, or this rhythm, would imply that we're going to fall back to something more trend line type, maybe even a little bit below trend line. So if you take that and you start multiplying that out, if we're going to have this switch over to soybeans, I actually think we're going to lose acres in both corn and soybeans. I think you're going to see a lot of acres go back into pasture or go into hay ground. There's a lot of money in hay, especially with the cattle herd back growing again. Hay is always valuable to us Texans. It's nothing for us to pay $10 a bale for hay. So if with Chuck's scenario, if we would lose a couple million acres, and I actually think USDA's 2 million too high this year, so if you ate 2 million below that, we might be talking about 86 million planted, huh? And then we only got about 76 harvested. If I was a cash short, I'd start getting worried, wouldn't you?
All right, let's go back to this end of the table for a second.
Where's that sombrero?
Yeah, no kidding.
the $5 level is on futures, Chuck, I think would make sense if you went below a 1.5 carryover. The market started to see that happening. You know, that's what it goes back to, is the market is supposed to be forward-looking. You know, sometimes it's not. It's backward-looking because of the data. Right. But if it's forward-looking and it's looking at a below a 1.5 carryover and it sees less competition out of the Ukraine because they can't cash flow corn acres this winter, then, you know, you should be able to get that risk premium up.
When you look at the LA wave, guys, that's what I started with. They're looking at 523. Maybe that's the type of scenario that can just all fit together where the fundamentals and the technicals can work all together all at once. One thing I've been doing with a few guys is maybe being a little patient on corn marketing for 2015 due to the idea of maybe less acres and some weather. What we've done is we've put some of these corn hedges into bean hedges. And we've come up with some strategies where you can put down 15 to 26 cents. We're doing it in the November 15 beans to protect our downside with the idea that maybe beans could, you know, be the weak one into next year. Well, a couple guys say, well, Kurt, how's that working for you? Well, pretty good so far, because for the early ones we've put on, we've lost 5 cents. The market's rallied 70 cents. I'll do that all day long. Corn's rallied 35 cents since we've done some of these. So we're looking at managing risk by looking for more return for what we put down. And that's kind of step one until we get a little further into this winter.
And you know, Chuck, when you talk about that, do you recognize that in South America, they are paid based on the U.S. dollars, but in their local currency? So just the opposite of us, they're being encouraged to plant more and more corn and more beans. In fact, to the point where the Brazilian government right now is really pushing corn ethanol plants. There's going to be 4 new corn ethanol plants built in the center to the west during 2015. They already have 2 in Mato Grosso. They're building another one right now in Mato Grosso do Sul. So, you know, they're anticipating more corn production down there. And if the dollar remains high, that's just more competition for us is what it is. So, you know, it's very hard to answer that question. I agree with Mike. You know, realistically, if we look there at 1.5, maybe we can. But again, you know, you have to be, the stars have to align properly for us to do that.
If we have a rally in December or in January, where to for price of corn?
Well, I'm not going to ignore that we don't have a big crop, and it's going to take a while for us. My guess is if I'm here a little bit, but it's where we're real critical here in the next week or two. This corn market needs to kind of catch in here. We need to see some demand pick up, and we did see last week's export sales did show some life, and I think you're going to see some more of that. And I think the cash short is short, super short. He still needs some cash. I think everybody was planning on buying this market a whole lot cheaper than what it got. So I don't think the end users have any kind of decent coverage. So that's been kind of an offsetting balance to you guys not being sold up enough. So that's been kind of the counterweight is that the end user hasn't got much coverage on. So I do think as we go down the road, we're going to see the end users come in and use this break that we're seeing in the marketplace, should stabilize, and we should go on up. I would follow it up closely from a technical point of view, kind of see if this market can kind of catch. If it does catch, then it's seasonally correct then to go higher as we probably go into that first week of January, and then we'll probably want to stall out. How high we can go, I think you have to probably say this, you know, $3.80 to $4 area is probably the top end on a lead month. And I think we're already probably in the process of taking the March contract down to where the December contract has been trading since we're only a few days away from expiration. And I suppose new crop, you know, you got to take a look at this, you know, 520 to 530 if you want to put a floor on it, is purchasing a put, maybe selling a call. But I like to have them a little further up the ladder than most guys do to kind of protect you if this thing does kind of want to fall apart this winter. There's going to be a real test in here this winter probably. But my Ouija board stuff says that we're fairly seasonal all the way into the summer.
We'll I thought your Ouija board said 520 for a moment.
Well, the 520 objective is they must be reading my Twitter wire. The 520 objective can be visualized by looking at a monthly corn chart.
Oh, hang on.
And looking at a stochastic indicator, even an RSI indicator. Most of your indicators, there is what you call a bullish divergence pattern, where prices went lower, but the technical indicator did not go lower with them. It held above the previous low on the technical indicator. So therefore, you get a bullish divergence pattern, and what that would imply is that you take out the previous high. And the previous high was, 519.5 we had in May or April. That would be the upside target. So that's what technicians are probably looking at. As long as the moving average systems continue to stay green on them, that's what they're looking at. They're not buying this market for a 20-cent rally. They're buying it for a bigger move. Now, whether or not it works, don't know. You place your bets. Technical analysis is one of these things is that you, and same way with my cycles do imply this thing is turning up out of a major low. So what you do is you just say, I think the fundamentals are going to start coming my way.
Right.
And bull markets, you always climb the wall of worry, and boy, there's a wall of worry out there.
Okay, remember, so technical analysis looking way forward, and he's reading the technicals, and hopefully, hopeful at this point.
Yeah, there's no guarantees.
Hopeful that the fundamentals will come there, but the technicals are saying that at the moment. So let's go back to this year's crop. I'm not going to go against the 14 billion bushels that are hanging out there, relatively speaking, and it's a big crop. I don't remember. I think everybody said, did everybody say store corn this fall? Yes. Yeah. Everybody said store
corn.
Well,
the basis, if you can store, is kind of a no-brainer. I'd hate selling 40, 45 under. I know.
Right. So the question is, what do you do with it? You've got it stored. So now I want to go through the three of you. What do you do with it?
Even commercial storage is paid in some areas. But, July futures, 410, 412, 415, I think, you lay into it and let the basis do the work. We sold a lot of March 410, 420 corn calls, hoping wrong. Just sit back and see what happens. But as Dan and other panels have suggested, the basis, we firm up in about mid-December here, so sit back and see what happens.
Well, I think one of the things, if you make the decision to store the corn, Dan just made the best statement there is. You better protect your carry in the marketplace. What's March doing? It's going down to where December's going off, because that's got carry built into the market to help pay for storage. So if you're home storing, why wouldn't you protect the carry, especially if it's only costing you 2.5 cents a bushel to do it, and you can protect 4 cent carry? We actually had more than full carry at one point in time in that marketplace. And so when you make that kind of decision, I think you have to look at what happens. What good does it do you if the carry goes away and the basis improves what the carry was? It just costs you, right? So I think you have to have a strategy that says, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to protect myself. I think they're right. And I actually think, that's the first time that the Mississippi River has closed up in Minneapolis on November 20th since 1969, the first time. So what does that say? That says if you live in Minnesota, North Dakota, you're kind of shot, because your basis is going to stink even worse than what it does right now. But if you're living in Decatur or someplace, your basis is probably going to improve quite a bit, because they can't bring the corn down the river to meet the need. So, if you're going to store it, you have to protect your carry and then try and do the basis play.
So if you have the basis expectation that you're going to go higher here in this part of the country, because we're going to feed what the North can't give us, but what we talked about earlier, then where do you go in December corn? I think that lead month futures price of 385, or that area where we made that high right after the report, is a very big number from a chart perspective. Same disclaimer as what Dan said about the technicals. But if you can get above that 385 on a closing basis, there is a gap at that 411, 412, 415 area on lead month futures that should not be that hard to go after, because there's not a lot of other resistance levels that you have to kind of go through. So the buy stops could be pretty substantial, I suspect, above that 385 close above. You get in that 415 area lead month futures, that's where I think you ought to be doing some more business on the future side, and then take a look at your basis and see if it's actually appreciated or not. I think the cash grain panel hit it this morning, but it's really worth noting that Decatur's gone from 28 under in mid-October to 8 over, and at the same time the futures market's rallied 60 cents. So you do have a premium in the corn market now. The market does realize that the crop was shorter, the weather delays occurred, da-da-da-da-da. So there is a level then that this corn market can get to. The biggest problem, other than the corn export demand in the near term for the corn and heading into the winter, that I see is the bean-corn ratio. Do the beans physically pull the corn down? If the beans go up, I think corn has a very good chance of going up with it. So that's kind of the two big things that I'm watching, is corn exports and the bean-corn ratio. That ratio, new crop, it's about 2.6, I think, right now, 2.46. It got down to about 2.3. a year ago in the springtime, and I would think you want to gravitate down towards that again, trying to buy corn acres.
Roger, you got a question? Because the price of crude oil is so low, do they have more available currency in foreign countries to purchase grain from whatever source, the United States in particular?
Well, that just depends upon where you live, because you know, crude is priced in American dollars everywhere. So if your currency rate is like Japan's currency rate, a $76.40 barrel of crude today is $90.46 to them. So they don't have a lot more currency. Now, China's a different story. I mean, when you look at the big picture, China's really only experienced about a 1.2% increase in grain prices, even though we've had the dollar move as much as it has, because their currency doesn't float with the dollar. But when you look at everybody else, that's just not the case. And so that's why, you know, China came in today and they bought corn, they bought beans. I don't doubt that they will. And part of China's situation is really interesting. You know, they chose to support their farmers at a much higher level, at a subsidy level, a number of years ago, because they want to be able to control the orderly move of people from the country coming into the city. Well, they happen to pick some of our highest priced times to do that. So their pricing that they have these guys supported at is so high that the consumer, or I mean the producer over there, or the manufacturer over there, is better off buying our grain. It's cheaper to buy it from us than it is to buy it from their local people. And so that's why they have this glut of grain that's building over there also. You know, so China, yes, I think China could do, you know, could they have lots and lots of extra currency. There's no question about it. But I do think when you look at everybody else and you look at the EU and you look at Japan and other major buyers of ours, it's just not as good a situation.
Other questions? Paul Cooley always said the trend is your friend, yes. Oh, which trend do you go by? It on, do you go by the trend is your friend on a weekly, a monthly, or a daily basis?
I look at all weekly, trend for, me. Is weekly your friend. For me.
Weekly monthly, continuous. Yeah,
the weekly continuous, yes. Which is different. Where's Wayne Nelson? Wayne, did Cooley go with daily? I thought that Cooley was probably, he was more of a trader. He was going with the daily. And you are on a weekly, right? And you say which direction? Based on the trend is your friend for corn.
Weekly's positive.
Weekly's positive. And you want to do
weekly,
monthly continuous. But the or weekly continuous.
Weekly continuous.
Lead option first month, continuous. And direction is?
It's positive right now.
Positive.
I've never seen so many cash grain traders watch a five-minute bar chart in my life.
Well, you're right. He's right about that. Well, are they really cash grain traders or are they just traders?
It's unbelievable.
I watched the five-second chart, so. The way I look at trends, basically a daily chart, you know, you can see, you can visualize a trend line, you can visualize a channel. You don't have to be, and I mean, you don't want
to expect
everything to be the exact, but you can spot a downtrend, and when prices start busting above that trend line, then you can begin to tilt your trend lines the other way. Now, this October rally was a pretty perfect uptrend channel. It stayed inside a channel. now we have kind of broken out of that channel that we had developed. So what we're doing now, I think, is broadening out the uptrend line. And we'll see whether or not these key Fibonacci retracement levels will hold the break in these beans and corn that we're experiencing here going into first part of December. If we can hold it, we start up. Then what you'd want to do is draw your trend line off of the October low and whatever low we carve out here in the next week or two, and then draw a parallel line, and then that's going to be your wide channel.
I think you got to throw a moving average in there. I think you got to kind of keep an eye on this 45-50-day moving average. I know a lot of these stock traders watch 100, 200-day moving averages, but I think if you go with that midterm moving average in there, that'll help you in case you can't draw those lines straight.
I've made note in the last year that we talk more about the technicals on the air across the board with all of our analysts than we ever have before. So why the change?
My vote would be the automated traders.
Yes. The black box trading?
The They're either following the USDA or some other large private source data and the binary codes, or they're following the charts.
Yep, I would agree, and I think the introduction of ethanol as well as the black box traders.
I get a phone call from just a few guys that want to know what's going on fundamentally. they manage money technically. And there's just a huge amount of vast money out there. These guys manage anywhere from $50 million to $1 billion, and they look at charts. Mm-hmm. And it's obvious if you watch the market and you trip these technical points, there's a lot of action that takes place. And so you got to respect that. And it's advantage to a producer because they're looking at the chart, then they look at the fundamentals later. You guys are up on the fundamentals. And so I think when they run the extreme, you can take advantage of that and, you know, lay off some hedges or do some cash replacements. But that's where the money's at. These guys got a staff that trade 24/7. They've got billions of dollars to work with, and that's where the money flow is right now, is the technical side.
Anybody else got a question? I've got two. We're going to take both. I'm going to do with Bob here.
It would make us like Greece.
Questions.
And I'm not too sure we're not headed there anyway. I mean,
they've asked what the reserves.
I know the dollar has strengthened some here over the past few months, but for the most part, we're still at a relatively cheap level. I mean, we're not even at the 100 index. I mean, we're way underneath the 100 or par, or whatever you want to call it. As far as I'm concerned, everybody takes their turn. It's a race to the bottom. Who can devalue their currency the quickest? Because everybody wants the export market. So you saw Japan come out with a humongous, gigantic quantitative easing program. Europe's going to do it. We're going to do it again, too. Because if you think this economy is purring, I got some land down in Texas that gets 200 bushels an acre.
Oh, that's a Paul Cooley question. When is, he would ask that at Christmas when we would go out. We used to go out.
Probably before the last
Christmas.
Blood
moon.
He would
ask moon. A question like that, which is, the question is, when is the Dow going to hit 20,000? We'd be sitting around.
Well, we got a blood moon in April, and then we got one next September, and that's supposed to be the end of the world. So we're running out of time.
Okay, let's wrap her up. We're going to let you do your final words here. We'll start, Dan, with you.
It's been fun coming back to Illinois. I don't want to stick around too long because I don't want to pay your taxes. It's nice living in no-income state tax Texas. But seriously, I mean, we do have adequate supply of grain, and the old trader's axiom, until that is moved into strong hands, and I mean the commercials, until the hedge pressure has got that all absorbed into the market, there's going to be somewhat limited upside potential in corn. We're probably going to find some kind of trading range in here if we haven't already done that. But I do think when you look ahead, once we get past it, we can get past the January crop report without any bearish surprises, maybe even catch a bullish surprise or two. The trade is quickly going to look at the new growing season for price direction, and that's going to be probably the leader. But be careful overstaying the market. If there's anything that I learned sitting in Decatur, Illinois for 5 years, is that when farmers sell, it's just a matter of time before the market goes up. When end users buy, it's just a matter of time before the market goes down.
That's right.
Kurt Kimmel.
I think as a trader, if you want to look at that point of view, there's going to be a lot of opportunity to take a little out of the middle this winter. I believe there's going to be a lot of bullish news, a lot of bearish news, a lot of back and forth. I don't know if volatility is going to go up a whole lot, but I think there's a lot of trading opportunities to take a little here and a little there. As a producer, I think the number one thing you need to keep in mind is stay flexible. The more flexible you are, the more opportunity you're going to have to be able to do well in your marketing. So push the pencil a little bit and keep that in mind.
Jackie Vakes.
First, I want to say thank you to all of you for coming out and supporting this first meeting that we've had here. It's awesome.
Thank you.
Say thank you to Todd and Dave and everybody else for putting it on, because and Farm Credit, we really appreciate that. I think the bottom line comes down to, and it maybe sounds too simplistic, but forget about everybody else and just look at yourself and say, what is my cost of production? What is my average cash price? And how do I manage my risk? That's really what it comes down to. It doesn't make a difference what your neighbor's doing, what somebody else says, or even what we say in that respect. You still have to know where you're at. That's the most important thing. And happy Thanksgiving to all of you.
Mike Zuzulo.
About to wrap up, we haven't talked about wheat at all, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say something about wheat. If the currency problem is going to become a problem for corn, it's going to show up in the wheat first, would be my guess, because the global competition for supplies of wheat is even greater than it is in corn. So watch for that in the short term, and thanks again.
Thank you to our panel. Give them a nice round of applause, and hang on just a second before you get up.